is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name is Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. An exotic pest has been found on some mango farms in Queensland. Today you'll hear from the Territory's Chief Plant Health Officer about the threat that this poses to the Northern Territory and the work being done to protect farmers.
So trying to work out whether there's some natural predators that can reduce the spread of or the incidence of this pest in the Northern Territory should it be detected in the future.
The remote island community of Warrawee is successfully growing all kinds of fruit and veggies in its market garden. But this beautiful fresh produce is now under attack. I'll tell you more about that in just a moment. And as the wet season approaches, Northern Territory pilots are getting the latest advice on how to dodge thunderstorms in light aircraft.
We know from this incident and other occurrences that 10 nautical miles isn't enough to guarantee safe passage. And some operators put in 20 nautical miles in their operations manuals.
We've got all kinds of stories coming up on the Country Hour today. Hope you can stick around. We're broadcasting right across the Territory on the ABC. If you need a duck out for whatever reason, you can always catch the program via our podcast. Listen at a time that suits you. That's the idea of the podcast. Well, for months and months now, the federal government has been talking about the ag visa. And for months and months, farmers have been waiting for this visa to be official and for workers to start flying in. Well, according to the federal ag minister, David Littleproud, the government is getting closer to having workers come in under this new ag visa, confirming today that talks are underway with Indonesia to become a participating country.
Yeah, we can publicly announce that Indonesia is one of the countries that we're negotiating with respect of the Memorandum of Understanding and a formal agreement with their government. That's a big step forward, and we're proud to say that it's our closest neighbour and very happy that they're being
but
able to...
But they haven't signed up yet.
No, but this is a signal, very strong signal of intent. To be able to say that they're publicly working through this is a very strong and very loud public statement by the Indonesian government. So we were obviously working through that. They are sovereign governments, as are the others that we're negotiating with. So we've got to respect that process.
So the sector and the government have been waiting a long time for this visa. Can you give any indication of a timeline as to when Indonesia or another nation might actually sign on the dotted line?
Well, we're hoping it'll be within a month. That's what we're hoping. But we can't push this because you would understand they are foreign governments, foreign and sovereign states that get to make their own decisions. But what we are doing is working behind the scenes with labour hire companies and approved employers to make sure that if any country, whether it be Indonesia or the other three that we're negotiating with, if they are to give us the formal notification, we are ready to move immediately.
Assuming it signs on the dotted line within a month, when could Indonesians be here to work on Australian farms?
Well, literally, that'll be weeks after that, because and it'll depend on the quarantining arrangements.
Quite quickly.
And that's why we're doing the back end of it at the moment, also with the labour hire companies and the approved employers. We're working with a cohort there to make sure that we can move as quickly as we can. We're also making sure that the states understand that at some juncture, their quarantine arrangements, as they've got in place now, will have to be met as well.
Can you tell us what other nations you're discussing bilateral or having bilaterals with?
No, I can't. That's disrespectful.
Could you tell us if any are from the Northern Hemisphere?
No, I can't tell you
they're
where
all
they
ASEAN
are.
Nations?
They're all the countries that we've started negotiations with are from Southeast Asia, and we're making sure we're working through that. These are the ones that we already have close immigration ties with, and we believe that if we start with those and then work through other bilaterals, we'll be able to build on this quickly.
Would you consider broadening the ag visa to allow people to work in childcare services or as au pairs in remote areas?
Well, that's not agriculture. This is an agricultural visa for seasonal workers, for semi-skilled and for skilled workers for agricultural pursuits.
Nice to be talking to you about the agriculture workforce, but all the attention on the Nationals this week has been on net zero target by 2050. When are you going to tell the Prime Minister that you're on board?
Well, we haven't got to that conclusion decision yet as a party room. There were a number of questions that were raised from the presentation that was provided to us on Sunday that our party room wants addressed. We've come to a conclusion about how that can be addressed. We've actually presenting that to the Prime Minister today, and then that'll obviously give the Prime Minister time to reflect and understand what our concerns are and what we believe our mitigants are. And then he'll come back to us, and the National Party party room will meet again on Sunday to determine the Prime Minister's response, and we'll make a determination about our commitment to what the Prime Minister wishes to take forward to Glasgow.
What can farmers expect out of this deal?
Well, safety and security that they're not going to be asked on to foot the bill, but can be part of the solution. And I think that's the opportunity here is that they shouldn't have to foot the bill any longer, but there is an opportunity for them to be part of the solution. And we've already started that with the stewardship program and the soil cut.
In a lot of ways, you've already done a lot of the work by setting up the Carbon Plus trial and trying to seek out these payments for biodiversity on farms. What more do you want?
Well, protections that future governments don't change direction and leave us paying the bill and holding the can. That's all we've done is we're looking at the mechanisms, the regulatory mechanisms to make sure that regional Australia, particularly primary producers, are protected, but they can be part of the solution. And the solutions can't be bastardised to have detrimental impacts on regional Australia and productive agricultural land. We think we can get the balance right. We think we've got that right with the stewardship program and the soil carbon piece that's being worked through the soil strategy. And what we want to see that is come to fruition, reward farmers, but we don't want a future government coming in and playing with that and at farmers' expense.
That's the Federal Minister for Agriculture, David Littleproud, speaking to Kath Sullivan just a short time ago.
G'day, how you going? It's Leo Skliros here, President of the Northern Territory Mango Industry Association, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Authorities in Queensland are busy checking out mango farms to work out the extent of an outbreak of mango shoot looper. Now, this exotic pest has never been found in Australia until now. The caterpillar, it's been identified on a group of mango farms in far north Queensland. Dr. Anne Walters is the Territory's Chief Plant Health Officer and has been busy working with her counterparts in the east over this issue. I spoke to her earlier on and asked how concerning this pest is for the Northern Territory's mango industry.
Well, look, like a lot of the pests that are found in other locations, so as you're aware, this particular looper was found in Queensland in September. We take it seriously. The mango industry is obviously our biggest horticultural industry in the Northern Territory, and we look into all of these pests to work out what impacts it could potentially have on the industry should it be detected here.
Since the biosecurity alert went out from the department over in Queensland, can you tell us what the department here in the Territory has been doing?
Yeah, so the first thing that we have a look at is what the risk is for the Northern Territory, particularly around movement pathways into the Northern Territory. So one of the things that we've had a look at is how it disperses. There's sort of three key things that we're interested in this space. One is natural dispersal, and that includes flight as well as wind dispersal. The second one is whether it can move on plant materials and fruit and products like that. And the third one is whether it can be moved by people. And so then what we do is we have a look at what the risk of each of those movement pathways is into the Northern Territory, and that helps us just to work out where we should be targeting our efforts. And in this particular case, I guess we're concerned particularly around human-assisted dispersal for this particular pest, and the reason for that is that it can disperse on the tops of caravans. So what can happen is caravans will park under a tree, the larvae will fall onto the top of the caravan, and then the caravan can transport them into the Northern Territory. So that's one of the key pathways that we'll be looking at.
What's the theory on how it got into Australia?
Well, yeah, I spoke to the Chief Plant Health Manager in Queensland last week, and at this stage they're not sure. They don't know where it's come from, and they're also still looking at how long it's been in the Northern Territory. Oh, sorry, in Queensland.
Well, just on that, we spoke to a mango grower, Leo Skliros. He said he wouldn't be surprised if it's already in the Northern Territory. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I guess that's one of the things that we also have a look at very early when we hear of these new detections. We also saw that there were some responses on Facebook to a post put out by NT Farmers that people had thought that it could potentially be in the Territory already. we have a look at our specimens and our databases and make sure that we haven't seen it previously, and we've done that, and we haven't got any records to suggest that it has been in the Northern Territory. What I can say, though, is that we do have other loopers in the Northern Territory, which might be what people are confusing it with. And when I say it, when it's a looper, I'm not sure how familiar the listeners are, but essentially it's those caterpillars that form the big arch of their back when they're moving. And so that's what we're looking at. But we have other species that are also loopers that we do have in the Northern Territory. So there's a possibility that people are seeing those and thinking it's this particular one, and it isn't.
When the department sees on Facebook a grower saying, oh, I think I've seen this at my place, I mean, do you contact that grower and get straight out there to start testing?
Absolutely. So we will contact. We also encourage growers to come to us. If growers are concerned, or if people feel that they might have seen this particular pest, please contact us on the Exotic Pest Hotline, 1-800-084-881.
What's your understanding over in Queensland on whether this pest can be eradicated or not?
Yeah, I don't know that we've got to that stage yet, or that Queensland has got to that stage. I think at this stage they're just trying to work out the spread. As you would be aware, they've found it over sort of a 30-kilometre distance, so that's quite extensive at this stage. So I guess they'll be pulling together all of that information so that they can make an assessment about how technically feasible it is to eradicate from Australia at this stage.
And have we covered the threat that this pest could pose to the actual industry? I mean, how bad is it? There's all sorts of bugs and grubs out there. How bad is this one?
Yeah, I guess that's one of the things that we'll be putting some resources into over the next 6 to 12 months. So one of the things that we'll be doing over the wet season is doing some surveillance. And then we'll also be going out and doing some surveillance during the flowering season, because this pest is particularly voracious on flowers. So first thing we'll be doing is some surveillance. And then the second thing we'll be looking at is, are there any natural enemies of this particular pest in the Northern Territory? So that's things like parasitoids that lay eggs within the caterpillars. And so trying to work out whether there's some natural predators that can reduce the spread of, or the incidence of, this pest in the Northern Territory should it be detected in the future. And obviously that work will have benefits for other loopers potentially, and so that's one of the benefits that we'll have from doing that work. So we will be looking at putting some resources into better understanding this pest and what the impacts might be in the Northern Territory.
Are there any deadlines coming up on when decisions will be made around eradication or control measures?
Yeah, so national meetings will be scheduled over the next few weeks to make some decisions around, you know, like I talked about, the technical feasibility of eradication and also cost benefit of eradication, and whether we're better to move to a transition to management phase.
So for all farmers and all home gardeners listening to this, Anne, what do they need to be on the lookout for?
Yeah, so if you see any unusual symptoms, if you see these looper caterpillars that you haven't seen previously, we'd really appreciate you contacting us on that 1-800 number. If, like anything, I guess we always put out the call to more generally about pests. If you have anything that you're suspicious about that you don't think you've seen before, give us a call. We're always really happy to come and have a look and give you a hand. So, again, that number is 1-800-084-881.
And if people jump on the internet and search mango shoot looper, they can find pictures of it. And to me, it's really almost that cartoon character type caterpillar, isn't it, with the sort of the big bendy back?
That's right. And it's a sort of a black caterpillar with white stripes. But it's some of the photos that they've sent over from Queensland, it has almost an orangish look to it as well, orange and black and white. So if people see anything that looks like that, feel free to give us a call.
Thanks for your time today.
A pleasure.
Dr. Anne Walters, who's the Territory's Chief Plant Health Officer, just repeating that exotic plant pest hotline again, in case you do see something unusual in the paddock or in the backyard, 1800 084 881.
G'day, my name's Amy Kirk. I study sharks and I bloody love them, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Our text number here at the Country Hour is 0487 99 1057. I've got a weather update from Jack in Timber Creek. G'day, Jack. He says, Matt, Timber Creek weather report, 43.6 degrees and far too much sun. It's been in the low to mid 40s every day for 2 weeks now, and no hint of rain. The Bureau's promising some spots on the weekend in our dreams, reckons Jack. Oh, that's tough going out there in the creek. Our text number 0487991057. We will be speaking to the Weather Bureau in about 20 minutes. The latest on bovine Yoni's disease management in Western Australia and what it all means for the Northern Territory's cattle industry. That's what we're talking about next on the Country Hour. But first, let's have a tune. The ARIA Award nominations came out yesterday. And so the nominees for Best Country Album, Brad Cox, Shane Nicholson, The Wolf Brothers, Troy Cassar-Daly. We heard one of his newest tunes on yesterday's program. And the final nominee is Felicity Urquhart and Josh Cunningham for their album, The Song Club. Here's a tune from that nominated album. It is called Wanna Go There.
I don't know where we're going, but I wanna go there with you.
Felicity Urquhart and Josh Cunningham. That song's called Wanna Go There from the album, The Song Club, which has been nominated for an ARIA. It is 10 to 1. You are tuned into the Country Hour. Now, if you've been listening to our program, you'd be aware that bovine Yoni's disease has been found recently on a property in Western Australia. And so after years of trying to remain BJD free, WA now set to ease its regulations around this cattle wasting disease. A government investigation into the outbreak found the disease had been on that property for several years, with almost 500 other properties possibly affected. Tracy Sullivan's the president of the Australian Cattle Veterinary Group. She says after consulting with industry, the WA government has conceded that eradication is no longer an option.
So now we're going to fall in line really with the rest of Australia. So the rest of Australia don't really recognise the difference between the S strain and the C strain, and they categorise it as one strain, because that's both strains do affect our export protocols. So West Australia was unique in separating the two strains. So now that we have recognised that we have got C strain as well, and that it is obviously been detected on the potential for it to be on quite a large number of West Australian places, we won't be able to eradicate it. So we have to go down the same route as the rest of the country and deregulate it.
And since all this has come to light, Tracy, what sort of conversations have yourself and your colleagues been having with the state government and industry?
Yeah, so the time frame for the actual deregulation hasn't quite been determined yet, so when exactly these new rules are going to come in for WA. But that will depend really. They just want to get the messages out to producers to know what to ask for and to have some biosecurity plans, in place and not know how importing cattle can affect them and what they need to be asking when they're buying cattle and what they need to be doing if they want to be selling cattle and with their approach to biosecurity, really. So there's going to be a bit of a transition period while producers are educated, yeah.
That's Tracy Sullivan from the Australian Cattle Veterinarian Group speaking to Courtney Fowler about the move to deregulate the management of bovine Yoni's disease in Western Australia, which after all these years is huge news. This decision will bring WA into line with other states and territories which deregulated BJD controls in 2016. It is welcome news to Northern Territory cattle producers and breeders such as Moira Lanzarin, who decided to stop selling cattle to WA earlier this year because of the issues and complications.
At the moment, the current regulations have just been getting harder and harder to gain access. And so we had initially jumped through all of the hurdles with the JBAS testing and made sure we had our biosecurity plans and our full JBAS 7 testing and your check testing and all of those type of things, and quite a lot of expense because you've got to get the vet out to do collect those samples and send them away and things. And then to hear that they've made it even harder, and so I ended up having to make the decision this year that we wouldn't even consider selling to WA, that it was just too expensive. And then to hear now that we might be opening the borders for that. That was quite exciting because I do have quite a large customer base in the Kimberleys, and it's a good potential market for progressive buyers of Brahmin genetics.
How far back does that relationship with WA go for you?
Yeah, look, at least back to the early 90s. I know when we were still in North Queensland, we'd sold bulls over into the Kimberleys. And then when we arrived in the territory in 93, we were regularly selling bulls into the Kimberleys and attending the Broome bull sale, and then in later years, Fitzroy Crossing bull sale, and then also just private paddock sales into the Kimberleys.
So that's been quite an important market for you over the years.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the one year there we sold our entire bull crop to one property in the Kimberleys. So that was a big incentive initially to make sure that we did the testing and stuff. But you just never know. Every year's different in bull sales and where people go and changes of management. And so, but it's nice to have the markets available to you as opposed to border restrictions.
How did it impact you when the JBAS testing started to come into play?
Yeah, look, it was an onerous expense, and so effectively it was costing us at least one bull just to do the testing and getting the timing and stuff of that all right. But it isn't only just bulls, it's potentially female breeders and stuff as well. And I remember in the early years, a friend had called in on their way back home to the Kimberleys, and I was like, oh, you don't happen to have a Jersey milker's calf for sale that I could buy, do you? And I was like, yeah, I've got a Jersey Brahmin that would suit your needs. And I was like, yep, we've done our JBAS testing and things. It happened to be an Easter weekend, so nobody was in the office to check paperwork, and we hadn't been able to get onto anything. But we put this lovely little heifer, Gracie, on the truck with the horses, and they got to the border to be told that my paperwork, my check testing was 1 week out, which I hadn't. I was thinking I was right for 2 or 3 years testing, which I would have been for everywhere else, but not into WA, it turns out.
So what happened?
And so we had to go over and pick her up and bring the heifer home.
Is that when it started to become too much for you?
No, that one, we still did testing on the possibility that you might have had buyers and stuff for future bulls and things. But then, and that was when we'd only had to do testing of 50 animals each year. And then this year, I think it was when they'd brought in that you had to be testing the whole herd. And I was like, okay, I'm not even going there. We were to the stage of, okay, if we had a really genuine inquiry of genuine sale from the Kimberleys, we'd go ahead and look at the testing then and figure it into the pricing structure. But just on the proviso that you might have a sale from there, it was too much.
So what does that news mean for you potentially?
Well, I don't know how quick the wheels of government and bureaucracy will turn as to when we might be allowed to send animals in again and what conditions they're likely to still put in place for us. And so I'm still waiting to hear back from the stock inspectors on that one. But I will start talking with WA producers again, and hopefully they'll also be keen to start looking at options of acclimatised northern animals ready to perform under really tough conditions.
Yeah, WA back on the table for Moira Lansren, who is with Kidati Brahmins, just south of Mataranka, talking there to Max Rowley.
Hi, I'm Casey Townsend from Hazard Station. We have the Little Miniature Cattle, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Now, the company that's planning to build the world's largest solar farm right here in the Northern Territory has signed contracts with a number of companies to help deliver the project. Dan Fitzgerald, Sun Cablers Inc. deals with who?
SMEC are on board. They will deliver the solar generation system for the project. A company called Hatch will deliver the HVDC transmission, so that cable...
That's the big power cable.
All the way over to Singapore. Marsh will do risk management, and PricewaterhouseCoopers will do project advisory. SunCable CEO David Griffin said in a statement, "To secure the support of these globally recognised experts is an important vote of confidence in the significance and the feasibility of SunCable's Australia-Asia power link." And also in some SunCable news, the company has also just been given approval to clear 9 hectares of land on Power Creek Station for a trial solar facility.
So Power Creek Station, it's an outstation of Newcastle Waters. Rightio, so they've got approval to clear 9 hectares and start building something.
Yeah, and when it's all done and dusted, I think it's something like 12,000 hectares that are needed for the entire project.
It's going to be huge. One of the financial backers of this is Mike Cannon-Brooks. On Twitter, he says, "Well done, team. Amazing job. Every step forward puts the naysayers further in the rear view mirror." Is Mike Cannon-Brooks. Hey, we've still got plenty to come on the Country Hour, including a cross out to our mates at Warrawee on South Goulburn Island. They've got all of this beautiful produce being grown, but it's now under attack. Tell you more straight after the 1 o'clock news.
Hello, my name is Beatrice and I'm from Wadea.
Hello, my name is Stephanie Berda and I'm from Wadea.
Hello, my name is Eugenie Gilbert. I'm from Wadea.
And you're listening to Country Hour.
Matt Brand with you this afternoon. In a moment, heading out to Warrawee on South Goulburn Island. The community there has got a market garden, and at the moment it's filled with all kinds of yummy fresh produce, but the food is under attack. Tell you more in just a moment. And also, the latest advice to Northern Territory pilots when it comes to avoiding thunderstorms when flying light aircraft. That's all coming up in the second half of the Country Hour. But now let's go to the Weather Bureau. Sally Cutter is there this afternoon. What's the story today, Sally?
Today we're basically looking at, there's a few showers and storms that work their way up the eastern border of the NT with Queensland. They're sort of heading off towards the Gulf of Carpentaria, but apart from that, it's all pretty, very quiet. We did have another warm night at Nooka, so they broke their record. They only got down to 29.8, which is probably, so it's calling to minimum, is probably not actually logical. Well, it is a minimum, but it's not what you think of a nice overnight temperature. It's
just about 30 degrees is not exactly a minimum, is it?
No. And remember, that's the lowest it got overnight. So it's spent most of the night warmer than that.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's dominated discussion all week, and fair enough, I guess. But in terms of this severe heat, do you have any good news for us on when we might get some relief?
If we can get those showers and storms happening, yes, you might get a bit of relief in the afternoon, and that's got the advantage that it will take the top off those maximum temperatures, so it won't get quite as hot, which is one of the components. Hopefully, also, it cools things down late enough in the day that it doesn't warm up again before the overnight temperatures start to drop anyway, and so we'll get some lower minimums. So what we are looking at is seeing the extreme heat wave that we're looking at easing to a low intensity heat wave. over the top end. It's sort of contracting out of that central parts of the NT, but up through the north, particularly over the Arnhem District, we're still going to be left with that low-intensity heat wave.
So are you saying your good news is we're moving from a severe to extreme heat wave to a low-intensity heat wave? That's about as good a news as we can get.
Yes, as far as the heat wave's concerned, it's...
Golly.
I think what this is just the fact that we've been breaking records, because Darwin got down to 28.9, which if we hadn't broken the record the night before, we would have broken the record last night.
Yeah, right. Wow.
I've
brought up the Darwin radar, and it suggests that to the west of Darwin, off Dundee Beach, there's a big long line of storms. But you've got your doubts, Sally Cutter.
Yeah, I've got significant doubts over that. It's not moving, so it's not really approaching. But also, if you look at the satellite picture, there's nothing out there. There is a line of slightly deeper convection, but it's running sort of along the Cox Peninsula. And there's basically nothing out there. It may be sea clutter. It could be all sorts of things out there, but we do have some inversions, so that's where the atmosphere is slightly warmer above, so rather than getting cool as you went to go up, it actually gets warmer, and it's not, and there's a couple of sharp ones of those, so it could be that the radar beam is trapped under there. So
how disappointing.
Don't get too excited about it.
No. Next few days for those in Central Australia and the Barkley, what's the forecast?
We've had that southeasterly come in. What we're now looking at is the proper southeasterly surge coming in over the weekend. So I suppose that is good news in some respects, because it does mean that we're going to see some slightly cooler temperatures down through around that Alice Springs area. So for Alice, we're looking at 36 today, 37 on Friday, but 34 on Saturday and 33 on Sunday. It then warms up again as we go into next week as the next trough approaches. But if you're in Tennant Creek, 42 today, 41 tomorrow, but then because we've already got that little bit of cooler air in the southern parts of the territory, when that southeasterly surge comes in, so Saturday drops down to 36, 35 on Sunday, 34 on Monday. But again, like the southern parts, with the winds turning northerly, we're going back up to sort of 40 by Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And the minimums are coming down. Monday morning, we're looking at a minimum of 23, which is better than the 28 we're expecting tonight.
Anything else we need to be aware of right now?
Not at the moment, just in the short term, things are cooling down in the south, maybe getting a little bit more active in the north, and then as we go into next week, those winds be picking up down through the southern parts of the NT, and we might see some storms. Storms may be a little bit gusty through the Barkley tomorrow and over the western top end today, but not expecting anything severe, but the gusty storms could return down to the south, into the Leicester, as we go into next week.
Thanks for your time this afternoon.
That's okay.
That is Sally Cutter there at the Weather Bureau. In terms of rainfall figures, up to 9 o'clock this morning, not too much to report. Mount Bundy North received 17 millimetres, the Upper Catherine River recording 9 millimetres, and the Upper Ferguson River recording 5 millimetres. And it's the temperatures that are making all of the headlines. Newry Cattle Station expecting a top of 44 degrees today. Elliot, a top of 43. Avon Downs, a top of 41.
This week on Landline, railway safety in the country.
We know with flashing lights that is the accepted indicator of a significant hazard. That's why they're there, and that's why we want them on trains, because they are dangerous. They're the most dangerous poorly lit vehicle on land.
And meet Australia's latest imported breed of sheep. Could they be any cuter?
We sold the first ones for $25,000 each, and we've sold our weathers for $7,000.
That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
The community market garden at Warrawee on South Goulburn Island is absolutely booming at the moment. Fresh produce absolutely everywhere. We're talking bananas, capsicums, limes, eggplants, heaps of mangoes, and plenty more. Now, this garden is all about supplying fresh food to the remote community, but at the moment this garden is facing a bit of competition. Steve Wesley is the chief executive of the local Yagbani Aboriginal Corporation. Steve, can you tell us about some of the challenges that this garden's facing at the moment?
Well, yeah, we've got crows and bats have moved in to share the delights coming from the garden. Yeah, they're doing a lot of damage at the moment, particularly the bats. Well, the crows come in the day and the bats come at night, so it's a 24-hour movement in the garden.
What are the crows doing?
Well, the crows, they'll just get in and they'll just basically peck the fruit. So they just damage the fruit, you know. And not only that, they'll eat our watermelons. They'll eat anything that's there.
I'm not a bird expert, but I thought crows were fairly rare in the Top End.
Look, we have a very healthy population of crows here, and in fact, we have what's called wark wark dreaming in this area. So, no, very prevalent here. There's hundreds of them on the island.
So there's hundreds of them. They've got their eye on your fresh produce. Tell us what the community's been doing.
Well, there's not a lot we can do. We pride ourselves with the garden being completely organic. The pest control is really hard. We've put nets over different things, and the guys are there to scare them away. The bats, that's another story, because they obviously come in, after midnight kind of thing, and there's nobody there. And, you know, there would have been several hundred mangoes on the ground the other morning.
So you've got the bats at night and the crows in the day?
Yeah, we have.
Is the netting working for you a bit?
Yes, for sure. Yeah, no, most definitely. A bit.
For our audience, can you explain what sort of beautiful fresh produce you've got out there at the moment? You mentioned the mangoes, but there's more than that.
Yes, there is. Yeah, there's. We have three different varieties of mangoes. We've got three or four different varieties of bananas. Our garden survived the banana freckle that wasn't infected when the NT had those issues a few years back. We've just recently had a plantain banana fruit, and so there's that. We have lots of herbs. We've got parsley and what else have we got in there? Parsley, there's ginger, we've got dragon fruit, we've got Kakadu plum in the garden, which we raised from seed, and that's that fruited for the first time last year, which is really exciting. We have finger limes, which are now fruiting. We have standard limes.
Wow.
Yeah, there's lots of pawpaws. There's two or three different varieties of pawpaws in there. Sugarcane, that's just to name a few.
And is that sold to the community?
It hasn't been. We've just only a few months ago got our certificate signed off to be able to supply fresh produce to the local store, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, what difference is that making to the community?
Well, you know, it's nice that it's we know where it's stemmed from. We know it's organic, and it's good community produce. You know, that money goes back into the garden and, you know, back into employment. So yeah, it's very positive.
I love the pictures that I've seen. You know, it's just people busy in the garden, people busy putting the food together in little packs.
Yep.
It's got a lot of people engaged from what I can tell.
Absolutely, yeah. The other thing is, you know, the guys take the fresh fruit up to the school nutrition program, so that goes back, you know, in the healthy tucker for the kids at the school. Yeah, so it's endless.
How good. Just need to keep those bats and crows away somehow.
That's the one.
Now, just before I let you go, Steve, over the years, one of our favourite stories from Warrawee, the oyster trials.
Yep.
What is the latest?
Okay, oysters are doing fantastic. They have, you know, our trials that we've done have exceeded everything we thought that our native black lip oyster would do. We believe they are world class oysters. We have adult stock on the farm at the moment, so we're basically ready to hit the marketplace, and we've just really just got to finish signing off on our aquaculture license, which goes hand in hand with our quality assurance to make sure that the product is completely safe for the marketplace, and we're ready to go. We've secured our Section 19 lease for the farm, and so we're in a really, really strong position.
That's exciting. When would you hope the first oysters hit restaurants?
Look, there's been a lot of people waiting for that. Yeah. Look, we were initially going to aim for this December when they're in their absolute peak. We've decided we'll hold off possibly until April now. Perhaps an Easter run might be good. And the really great thing is the first run with our oysters is limited to sales in the Northern Territory. So Territorians are going to get to have the first taste of these fantastic oysters. How good's that?
So much going on in your part of the Territory. Thanks so much for your time on the Country Hour.
Yep, no worries. Thank you.
G'day, Sam Nowen from the Darwin Aquaculture Centre. Been managing the trials for oyster production on Goulburn and Tiwi Islands. Gotta love a Territory oyster, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Steve Wesley out at Warrawee this afternoon. Big thanks to him for sharing his time. Best of luck battling those crows. It is 18 past one. You are tuned into the Country Hour. As the wet season approaches, Northern Territory pilots are getting the latest advice on how to dodge thunderstorms in a light aircraft. You'll learn more about that after a tune by Gary Allen. Right across the Territory on the ABC, you are tuned into the Country Hour. Flying small aircraft during the wet season, it can be challenging. Pilots are often dodging storms and at times can find themselves in some pretty scary situations. So that's why CASA and the ATSB have given a seminar to pilots this week to help refresh their skills and answer questions. Senior investigator with the ATSB, Peter Ayres, spoke to Dan Fitzgerald about an incident that happened back in 2019.
The job was to take passengers from Elko Island to Darwin, pick up another passenger, and then head off down to Tyndall. The forecast for Darwin at the time had a probability of thunderstorms, which pretty common for the time of year. Aziz's meeting is passenger. The controllers are diverting other aircraft around this weather that's building up at the moment. And the aircraft's given a delay on the ground. He's given a delay of about half an hour, which he accepts. During that half an hour, he's using the forecasts and the weather radar to assess what's going on with the storm cells on track. And the use of the weather radar showed him that it was dissipating. There's a couple of issues with using the weather radar for that. One, that closer cells can absorb the energy of the radar and further cells give less of a return, making them look smaller, or maybe they don't appear at all. And the radar itself has a lag of about 10 minutes because it requires a number of scans to develop the picture that it shows someone on their device. But it looks to him like it's dissipating. It's sunny where they are, but there's dark clouds down the end of the runway. They take off and head off on their track down to Tyndall. And about 10 miles out, the weather's starting to close in. There was a passenger took photos of the weather, which was great for the investigation, because she was worried about it. And when you look at those photos, you know, and think back to when I was flying, you know, have I seen similar scenarios through my window? Well, yes, I have, you know. Did I fly through it? Yes, I did. And did anything happen? No, it didn't. You know, I was fine. And that's clearly what was expected on this occasion too. Turns out, through my flying career, I must have just been lucky that nothing happened, because very suddenly and without warning, there sustained a severe and sustained turbulence event. There was no control over the aircraft. The pilot reported no control in heading, height, in airspeed. He said that a full control deflection in one direction, the aircraft would still turn and roll in the other. This would be a particularly scary situation. The telephone that the lady took the photos with wound up in the pilot's rudder pedals. For the most part, objects in the aircraft were strapped down, but there was still, you know, an iPad and a checklist floating around as well. And while the passengers were strapped in, you know, the fact that the pilot couldn't communicate with them and that this onset was so sudden and without warning meant that they weren't braced. you know, they didn't have opportunity to really tighten their belts and adopt a brace position and protect themselves. The 210's got a folding seat in the middle row, and one passenger had a lot of difficulty bracing herself with that. After about 3.5 minutes, control was eventually returned at about 1,300 feet AGL. We'd lost a good couple of thousand foot in the event, and the aircraft continued on to Tyndall with a few normal bumps and a bit of rain and landed out there. During the event, the air traffic controllers could see the ground speed of Sierra Juliet Whiskey at about 210 knots and a rate of descent of about 5,000 feet per minute, which is, you know, an incredibly quick rate of descent.
Yeah, that would have been pretty scary for those on board.
Yes, Oh, they'd have been terrified, yeah. It would have been awful and a long, long time to experience it.
So what can be learned from this incident, and especially for the distance that pilots should be putting between their aircraft and a thunderstorm in the wet season?
So we know from this incident and other occurrences that 10 nautical miles isn't enough to guarantee safe passage. And some operators put in 20 nautical miles in their operations manuals. You'll find the answer varies across operators and across different regions across the top end of Australia. If, you know, you've got storm cells on track and you want to give a cell a 20 nautical mile berth, well, that might cost you 50 track miles. And depending on the kind of aircraft you're in, that might be 20 minutes or half an hour of extra fuel to carry just for each diversion, because often there's, you know, more than one cell also.
If I'm on a remote cattle station, I'm about to jump in my plane, ready for a flight, I don't have any internet, I don't have any access to weather, it is a bit stormy around, what sort of preparation should I be doing?
Well, for a start, if you can call someone at your destination and ask them what the weather looks like there, that's a huge help. If you know, as I imagine a lot of station owners do, know the area and have known it for a long time, they'll be familiar with the build-up of thunderstorms and to always expect them at this time of year. You need to give yourself time and space from these things. You know, yes, we can miss it by 20 miles, but maybe we could also miss it by a couple of hours. You know, so you plan your flight so that you're not in the air when these things are developing and rolling through.
The pilots on cattle stations, they're often solo operators. They don't have any colleagues like somebody in a charter service might do in Darwin. Why is it important for pilots to talk to each other about their experience and get support?
Well, that's right. And if a pilot works in a commercial outfit, they have an organisation behind them, and that organisation is, you know, a large collection of expertise and a large collection of learnings, and they can draw on that to help them out. If a pilot is a private operator, they don't have that backing, you know, so they need to identify a network of support of other pilots, perhaps of, you know, friends in commercial operations. And if they find themselves having been through a stressful situation with their aircraft or with questions over their aircraft, they need to be able to contact someone who can give them an objective view on their situation and help them make a decision.
That is Peter Ayres, who is with the Australian Transport and Safety Bureau, speaking there to Dan Fitzgerald. That's all we've got time for on today's Country Hour. I hope you've enjoyed the program. I'll catch you tomorrow. It'll be Friday. See you at 12:30. Keep it rural.